for me, a lot of my vision is creating a very collaborative environment, creating an environment where people feel empowered, creating an environment where people feel very positive, and they feel like they're learning and they're growing professionally and personally all the time.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. Suri Kazarir was once like many activists. She believed passionately in a cause. She felt a mission in life. She wanted to make big changes in the world, and she did. But there came a time when that mission also seemed all-consuming. Because here's the thing. Missions come with a downside. Sometimes it just isn't clear how to build on them. How can you make a living on a mission? How can you feed your family and build a career while staying true to what you believe? How can you be successful when you define success in such a personal and passionate way? That's why I wanted to talk to Suri, because she spent a lot of time thinking about this, and she found a solution that works for her. For most of Suri's life, she didn't think of herself as an entrepreneur. She was an activist, and she was working tirelessly to help Jews from the former Soviet Union emigrate to the United States. But today, she's also running one of New York's biggest lobbying firms, and that enables her to have a fulfilling career while also creating change at a much larger scale. So how did she do it? I sat down with Suri on a recent morning in New York City to find out how she has achieved incredible success in a place they say, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere.
Well, I always wanted to be an advocate. I think from when I was very young, I always was the person who was standing up for injustice, organizing around the school activities, being the representative to go to all the rallies, fighting for the Jews in the former Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. I think that I always felt I could organize and advocate for the underdog. And that was always very exciting to me. I did what everyone in my family did, was go into education. My father was a teacher, my brother was a teacher, and that was very valued in my family. And I was very, very interested in the Jews in the former Soviet Union. As a young person, I was involved in an organization called the Student Struggle for Soviet Jews. We wore bracelets at the time for various refuseniks, and decided to actually go to the former Soviet Union and raise some money with a friend of mine while we were in college. And we took a trip and came back and really talked about the various people that we had met with, told their stories. We must have done 250 speaking engagements. It was kind of just a fun thing.
Yeah.
We spoke at Hadassah groups. We spoke on college campuses. We spoke at Hillel groups. We would just organize house parties at different people's homes. And at the end of it, we would say, please write to your members of Congress. Please write to the senator. Please write to the president. We'll give you letters, sample letters, and please write on behalf of these folks. And we had a slideshow and really made each of the stories of each of the refuseniks that we had met with come alive. And one by one, every one of these folks got out. And it was really powerful to realize the power of advocacy and what you really can do to change the world.
Yeah.
It was a very exciting time to be a young person and an advocate. My family is from Syria, and I learned that there were 4,000 Jews that couldn't get out of Syria. And I was struck by the fact that everybody was involved in focus on the Jews who were in the former Soviet Union, but nobody really was focused on the Jews that couldn't get out of Syria. So I went to some of the leadership of the Syrian Jewish community, many of whom were my friends that I knew from college. And they were very successful business people, the owners of the Conway store, the owners of Sound Design. And I went to them and said, you know, what are we doing about this? And they said, well, if you agree to be the executive director, we will fund the organization. And so we went about founding an organization, and we did a lot of international diplomacy and advocacy. And we were able to get those who wanted to leave the opportunity to leave. And once that happened, I really realized that I was onto something. And I never really thought through my own career trajectory in a very organized way. I was in education, as I said, as a fallback. Almost, because that's what everyone in my family did. And while I enjoyed it, it wasn't really where my heart was.
Right.
So I thought if I wanted to be an advocate, I really needed to work in politics and understand how the political process worked, and then do a stint in government. And I went to work for Mario. I went to work on the Clinton campaign in 92, and then went to work for Mario Cuomo in 94.
Now, how did you find how, and now this makes sense of why today you're this incredible lobbyist and advocate for so many causes. But at that time, take me back, like you, it sounds like right then and there, like that first time that you were able to get Soviet Jews into the U.S. or from Syria, like that just struck this chord. You realize you need to go into politics. You want to have that background. But how do you get a job on the Clinton campaign or working for Mario Cuomo? I mean, the governor of New York.
Well, I was always a very, very good networker and always somewhat interested in politics. I had a friend who worked for David Dinkins, who was the mayor at the time. I knew him through my work in the Jewish community. And I remember that there was a Democratic convention at Madison Square Garden, presidential convention. And I had said to him, I knew he had the ability to give out tickets. And I said to him, could I get tickets? And he said, sure, but you know, I'm going to give you like the tickets, like the worst tickets.
Right, like in the upper deck. Yeah. The blue seat, the old blue seats yeah, exactly, in Madison Square Garden.
Exactly. And he said to me, listen, if you're worth anything and you're interested in this business, I'll give you 5 minutes to be on the floor of the convention. And I was like, oh
wow,
my God. And sure enough, 5 minutes later, I was on the floor.
Of course you are. Yeah.
Don't ask me how I did it, but somehow I like managed to find some people and, you know, hustle myself down with a group. And I was on the floor and we started to laugh. And he said, all right, if you're interested, I'll help you. And at the time he said, you know, Mario Cuomo had a long time rabbi that he was very close with, Rabbi Moshowitz. And he passed away. And, you know, he said to me, you know, Mario Cuomo happens to be looking for somebody who knows the Jewish community. And I thought, well, I don't really, I mean, I'm Jewish,
right,
but I don't really know the Jewish community, certainly not statewide. I didn't have those kind of contacts. But, you know, he got me an interview and I was not picked. It was between me and somebody else and the other person got the job. And so he said, well, you know, I'm sorry you didn't get the job, but the Clinton campaign is looking for somebody.
There you go.
And so I got the job. I went in, I got the job at the Clinton campaign. And the next day, I remember I was, as I was leaving, they had just told me that they got the job. They said, you're going to start tomorrow. I left. And at the time I was calling from a hard line, you know, from a cell phone, to my answering machine. And I got the message. This is, I'm calling from Mario Cuomo's office. Please call us right away. And I was shaking. I called, this was 2 days after I got rejected. I called from a payphone and they said, well, the other person didn't work out and we'd like to hire you. And I said, well, what am I going to do? I mean, I just took a job at the Clinton campaign. So I went in to resign at the Clinton campaign, which I hadn't even started my first day. And they said to me, well, we're actually, this is the Cuomo operation that actually runs the coordinated campaign. And so I said, you got to be kidding me. And they said, look, if we could arrange for you, for the Cuomo folks to hold off, would you stay on the campaign till it's over? And I was so nervous because I said, I don't want to lose that job.
Sure.
And they said, look, we'll just give us a chance to work it out. And they navigated it. And so I was able to work on the campaign. And when I finished, I was actually like the only person that had a job because everybody was waiting for the jobs in Washington.
Right.
And it took months on end. So everybody was unemployed.
Right.
And I was the only one that had a job.
Right.
Because it had been lined up. And so, you know, it was really a very exciting time. It was the governor's last fourth term. He was running for re-election. And so I worked for him for 2 years and then worked on the re-elect, which didn't work out. And so it was after that that I kind of was trying to figure out my next step.
And take me back to exactly then. You end up going to work, and it sounds like for a bunch of years for Governor Cuomo. You must learn so much about politics in New York City, New York State. I mean, that must have, it seems like that was your education. So is that true? And then do you take that and then say, hey, I want to go start my own business where I can really help people?
Well, actually, I really never wanted to start my own business. I never saw myself as an entrepreneur, which is very interesting. I was looking for a job. At the time, I thought, wouldn't it be great to work for like a university and do government affairs, or wouldn't it be great to work for a hospital? And so I was looking for that in-house government affairs job. And at the time, I was meeting with tons of people. And people gave me lots of good ideas. But every time I would go for one of those jobs, they would say, okay, so where were you the director of government affairs? And right. I would say, well, you know, I've never been the director of government affairs, but I worked for the governor of the state of New York. I worked on a presidential campaign. I worked on the governor's campaign reelect. And they'd be like, yeah, but you haven't actually been a director of government affairs. And a friend of mine said to me, you know, you should think about looking at the business improvement districts because it would be a way, they're quasi-governmental, and it would be a way to kind of move into the business world. And so I went for an interview for the director of marketing for the Downtown Alliance. It was a new business improvement district that was actually a little bit more interesting than some of the others because it was trying to change downtown to a 24/7 community.
And what year was that?
That was in, I would say it was maybe in 96.
Okay. So nothing going on downtown at that time. Obviously,
no.
That's why they...
You know, and they were taking a lot of these commercial buildings and trying to make them residential. And so the new BID director, Carl Weisbrod, who's a very dear friend till today, said, you know, I have a job that you might be interested in, and it's the director of marketing for the BID. And I interviewed, we hit it off, and he said to me, where have you been the director of marketing? And I was like, well, I haven't, but my whole life I've been marketing things and I could certainly be a person who can market something. And he said, well, it's between you and the head of marketing, the former head of marketing for American Express. And right then and there, I knew, okay, great, I'm not getting this job. So he gave the job to her, but he said to me, you know, I really like you and maybe I can throw you some consulting work. And I said, look, I'm looking for a job. I really appreciate it, but you know, I'm not interested. And you know, he pursued me and he kept saying, look, while you're looking for a job, like why not do a couple of projects for me? So he convinced me and I just kept saying, look, just know that this is short term because if I find a job, I'm out of here. So he said, okay, no problem. And, he threw me a project, which was Garry Kasparov, who was the world chess champion, was playing at the Borough of Manhattan Community College. And he said, I'd like you to try to promote this. And I thought to myself, look, who cares about this? Like, how in the world am I going to promote this? And he's like, no, really. The guy has a huge world following and people love chess. And there's an international community, but tremendous, tremendous interest in New York and this Garry Kasparov. And I thought, all right, fine. You know, he's like, said, I'll pay you like $1,000, you know, whatever. And I like, so at the time, Bruce was my boyfriend. He was working for Giuliani. And he was the one who actually convinced me to just send in my letter of resignation when Mario Cuomo lost. He said, look, don't try to sell yourself to the Republican. You're a Democrat. You're like, you're a political appointee. And so, and anything I could do to help you. So I called him up and I said, listen, I said, I got this world chess champion and champion guy, Garry Kasparov, and maybe you'll have a press conference with him to announce that he's playing in Lower Manhattan. And he's like, sorry, like, why would I do that? You know? And I'm like, because he's got like a world following and, you know, Giuliani had just become mayor in 93. And I said, look, you know, he comes with huge, huge press network and it'd be great for you. And, you know, he's like, okay, fine, I'll do it. And so I said, you're going to hit it off with him. He's a great guy and super, super charismatic and smart. And so Giuliani agreed to do it. And we had them in a holding room. They really hit it off. And Giuliani calls me over and says, look, you know, he seems to love New York. You think maybe he would play the World Chess Championship here in New York? I said, I don't know. Let me ask him. So he says, look, I'll go to the bathroom. When I come back, you'll let me know. So he leaves and I say to Kasparov, oh, I love New York. This guy's the greatest guy. Law and order. He's my kind of guy, you know? And I said, listen, you know, would you consider if he invited you, you know, in the middle of the press conference, if he invited you to play in New York, would you agree? And he's like, are you kidding me? In a second. So he says, all right, look, I said, you go out a minute and let me talk to him. So I talked to Giuliani. I go, like, he'd love to accept that. And he's fantastic. So we set the whole thing up. And Giuliani, in the middle of the press conference, they're laughing, they're hitting it off. And he's like, you're playing in Borough Manhattan Community College. I want to welcome you. And, you know, we're so proud to have you here. And, you know, I understand in a couple of months, you know, there's the World Chess Championship. What about if you would play it here? We should have the World Chess Championship here. And Kasparov says, oh, that's a great idea. I would love to do it. I accept. And all of a sudden, there is like the loudest like noise in the room. People are like, oh. And I'm like, oh my God, what did I do? Right. So this is already done. And afterwards, everyone comes running over to me and they go, what did you do? And I'm like, what's the problem? And they're like, it's already scheduled for Berlin. You know? And now what are we going to do? How do we get out of this? So Carl Weisberg calls me up and he's like, you just talked yourself into another job. He's right. Like, you now have to work with Giuliani and the government to try to figure out where we're going to play the World Chess Championship. So I then got that job and, one thing led to another. And I worked with Carl for quite a number of years. Bruce and I were getting married and we were paying for our own wedding. And I just started to take on more consulting work. And I kept saying to Bruce, like, I got to find this job. Right. I'm so busy with this consulting work, but I can't lose track of the fact that I've got to find this job in government affairs at some in-house place. And Bruce was laughing at me. He's like, you have a business. And I was like, I don't want a business. He's like, you got 9 clients now. And like, you have a business. And then one of my clients was trying to expand their space. And they said, would you come take an office and we'll share a conference room? And I was like, I'm looking for a job. Right, I don't know what you're talking about. And so it took me a very long time to sort of change that mindset of like a job and my own business.
And how, first off, I knowing your husband, Bruce, and I can only imagine when he was like, Suri, what are you doing? You have your own business. Just take this job, which would be
right.
So him. But like, it's so great. Like, you got that push. But it sounds like at that time, your mindset had always been coming from a family of teachers. First, it was universities or teaching, education, advocacy for that. But now, this must have been a crossroads for you because starting your own business, getting a couple of deals, consulting, but starting your own business and going out there, putting your own name on the door, that has to bring up a lot of fears. Were you battling those fears at that time? And was that where you needed that push?
You know, it's funny because in some ways I was sort of just like bumbling along, you know, and it sort of just happened. And I often think like if I really thought about like writing a business plan and like getting like investors and, you know, that I probably would have been too scared to do that, but it was sort of one thing led to another and I kind of just kept going. I really needed the money, so I kind of couldn't stop. And so one thing led to another, but I never really thought about like having an office. I never really thought about hiring staff. And almost till this day, it's kind of a mindset like, oh no, what happens if I can't do this all on my own and this whole thing falls apart? But one of the things that was great about what I do is that I always felt like I need a desk, I need a phone, and I can like
you can do it.
I can do it. It's really, it was me for a long time. Now I have almost 40 people who work for me and real experts in very, very different areas of the business. We have an architect who runs our real estate group. We have folks who have our lawyers and have expertise in legislative work. So I think we've come a very, very long way in terms of the quality of people that I have around me that support me and do so much of the work and are so successful at what they do and bring so much talent to the table. But I think had I really thought it through, I would have been really scared. But somehow it just sort of happened very, very
organically. Sounds like you kept getting jobs and it happened organically. You just said about going back then, you kind of felt like it was you and like that mindset of like things could fall apart. And it's very interesting because I interview a lot of entrepreneurs who continue to have that mindset. And now you have this major number one lobbying firm in New York. You have incredible major clients. Do you still deep down feel that same way?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I would say that every single time we get a new client, there's always a part of me that thinks, I'm not sure we can do this, you know? And I always sort of preface taking on a client by saying, I just want to tell you that this is going to be very difficult. This is a tough climate to achieve what you want to achieve. You know, here's the way I'm thinking about this. But I feel like oftentimes I kind of undersell. It sometimes worked to my advantage because, you know, it kind of lowers expectations.
Yeah, over-deliver.
Under-promise, over-deliver, right? But I don't think it's a strategy. It's often like just my own fear of like, can we really get this done? So yeah, I definitely feel, I think one thing that was really hard for me is that when you work for somebody like Mario Cuomo, the governor of the state of New York, you're not afraid of anything. You can pick up the phone, you can call anybody and you can say, I'm calling from the governor's office. Or when you answer the phone, you say, you know, Governor Cuomo's office. You know, you kind of have that big personality and you're behind them.
Yeah.
And I think what was really hard for me is to sort of put a price tag on, okay, how much would your consulting services be? And like, we want you and we want you to be out front and we want you to be engaged in every aspect of this work. And it was a very different mindset because I was so used to promoting somebody else.
Yeah.
So I think that that was really, I think, hard for
was,
me.
Yeah. Was it hard promoting yourself? Was it hard figuring out like what to charge? Like as a consultant and not being in the consulting business, how were you able to determine and realize what you should be charging and how much time and effort you should be putting into it?
Yeah. I mean, until this day, I mean, my business would not allow it to take success fees. Till this day, I have clients who say to me, you know, we'd like to give you a success fee.
A success fee? What? Just to explain to our
so
listeners.
So success fee would mean, you know, if you are able to accomplish what we set out to accomplish, we would give you an additional bonus or
gotcha.
Additional money
right.
or, you know. And we are a very, very regulated industry. We're regulated by both the city and the state. You have to register your contracts online. You have quarterly registrations where you have to register how much you're getting a quarter and what you're doing for that money, who you plan on lobbying on behalf of what issues. And you can only take the fee that is listed in the contract, and you're not allowed to have any kind of, if we get this done,
right.
then. So even like a lot of times people say, well, can you structure the contract so that if we get out of the gate, then we'll continue the contract or we'll pay a little more. And even that, you know,
yeah,
the commission, the lobbying commission has said borders on a success fee.
Gotcha.
So you can't say, well, if I get you a meeting with Senator Schumer, then we're going to pay you an extra $10,000
right.
or whatever,
right.
because that's considered a success fee. So it's oftentimes hard, you know, someone is saying to you, well, we're going to pay you, but you may, what proof do we have that
right.
you're going to definitely get our issue done? And I say, like, you don't have any proof. All you have is that I'm going to try as hard as I can, that I have a history of achieving things for clients,
yeah.
and you can speak to other clients of mine, and I can give you references, but I can't promise that I can get done what you're asking for. Because even if it seems like it's possible, we're in an incredibly precarious environment,
yeah.
and anything can change at any moment, and we're at the whim of lots of people's decisions.
Yeah.
So we can try to get stakeholders to engage. We can try to communicate the message in a way that is easy to digest and understand. We have the relationships to get you in the room and get you a hearing. We understand how people in government think, so we can prepare you for the meeting, but we can't promise
sure,
success.
You can't. I mean, that's, you know, impossible to do no matter what it is. You never know. But talk about, they say if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere in terms of New York City. And I've just always heard, like, you know, whenever I talk to anyone who's worked in New York City, specifically government, like, it's impossible to get anything done. But you obviously have gotten things done, or is it a crazy environment? Like, what is it like? Are there so many people who have their hand out or that are involved? Is it, and has it become harder?
Yeah, I think I would say that it has become harder. I think that it's become harder. So we have a not-for-profit business, which lots of our not-for-profit clients are engaging in real estate projects. They may be engaging, they may have legislative concerns, either promoting their own legislation that they feel needs to be enacted, or they're fighting legislation that is going to affect them mm-hmm. in a negative way. But in terms of the real estate and the corporate sides of the business, it is a very challenging environment. We're dealing with a very progressive, democratic leadership, and they're not necessarily sensitive to the business interests.
No, I mean, like, look at the whole Amazon situation.
Yeah.
To me, I mean, that just, I was floored. Like, we had an opportunity for this major business to come in here and provide so many jobs to revitalize. I mean, Long Island City's doing good, but like, I just, that's got to be so difficult, especially for your clients, like, in that type of.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like, for those of us that are close to the ground, I think we saw a lot of that unfolding. And I've been talking to my clients for a long time about the sort of reality on the grassroots and on the ground in communities, and how important it
yeah.
is to engage with local communities and make them stakeholders in what you're trying to achieve. And I think there were lots of things that went wrong here, and it can be like a separate
session,
you know, on what went wrong on the Amazon deal. But I think that, not to blame Amazon in any way.
No, I think
but
it's
I
us.
Think they were unprepared for how much work needed to happen on the ground.
Right.
And I think they assume that if they had the mayor and they had the governor, that they were going to them behind them, like what could go wrong? And,
yeah,
they, and that
yeah.
they were bringing jobs and
providing thousands right. of jobs. I mean, who?
Right.
But that's what shows about New York. And that shows what you must have to face every day for your clients. Like these little, like if Amazon can't get that done, like I would imagine you have a lot of clients who really need your services.
Yeah, look, I think that, you know, we're very big believers in engaging lots of stakeholders. And I think engaging the unions who really had a lot of benefit from these jobs, engaging the New York City Housing Authority, which was right next door, and really working to make sure that they felt invested in some of those training and some of those jobs, and really working with the local elected officials. What was so strange about the Amazon situation is that it was a very vocal minority. And honestly, Rob, when they began, I believe that they never thought they would be successful.
Sure.
Certainly the elected officials, if you would have said to them, by the way, you know, Amazon may walk away.
Right.
They would have said, you're crazy.
Right.
So nobody expected this outcome. And I think for them, we are going into 2021, which will be a major change in New York City government. We have 51 council members, 36 of them are term limited out. We have 5 borough presidents. All 5 are going to be new. One will be decided this January, but the other 4 will be in 2021. There'll be a new controller, a new mayor, a new speaker of the city council. So in an incredibly political environment, and Queens has been the hotbed of the Democratic Socialist Progressive Movement with people like AOC and Tiffany Caban and lots of others. And so I think it's really important in every situation to really read the culture of every community and to read what's really going on the ground and really engage in a very, very meaningful way with both citywide stakeholders as well as local stakeholders. And I think that Amazon is an example of what didn't work if you don't do that.
Yeah, that's so true. So for you and your business and moving forward today, like you said, so much in terms of the business is you have to focus on who the leaders are and the politicians and major changes coming. How do you prepare your business? How do you prepare, you know, your agency to handle that? Are you on that now? Are you dealing with that now? Are you preparing?
Yeah, very much. Both in terms of building relationship with organizations that are part of the progressive movement and elected officials that are part of that, as well as really engaging with right now with all of the unions. There are some incredibly powerful unions, whether they be Gary LaBarba, the head of the building trades union, or the head of 32BJ. Now there's a new head of 32BJ who's fantastic. Mm-hmm. The longtime head of 32BJ passed away recently. Mm-hmm. And Peter Ward, the head of the Hotel Trades sure. Council. Stuart Applebaum, the head of the Retail Workers Union. So engaging with all of those folks is incredibly important because they really understand the intersection of business and community, and they really understand the benefits that business brings to the table. And I think having them front and center is sometimes even more beneficial than having the business or the real estate company front and center. And also really being able to tell a good story. Are you creating jobs? What benefits are you bringing to communities? You know, Rob, one of the fallacies that exists is that if you bring affordable housing to a community or you bring some benefit to the community will sign on to a major real estate project. And I think that one thing that's going on in communities today that people need to keep their eyes on is a real fear of displacement. It's a fear of gentrification.
Yeah.
And so if you bring the most beautiful park to a really underserved neighborhood, what people hear is my rent is going to go up and
right.
I'm not
they
going
don't
to be able
hear
to
about the park and I'm going to be able to use the park, which is really true. What's happened, I mean, when you see it in a lot of neighborhoods in New York City, I mean, as they've become more gentrified, I mean, become it's hard. It's hard for a lot of people to afford the rents there. So I totally agree.
And as you know, so many of our friends today are spending probably 60% of their salary in rent.
Oh, yeah.
So if that were to go up, where would they go?
Yeah.
And I think that that is true for many of the people that fought in Long Island City that fought Amazon, they were feeling like if Amazon came to this neighborhood and our rents did go up because everyone's going to want to live near here and it's going to be a more better neighborhood, where are we going to go? And what are we going to be able to afford? And so that's the driver. And I think if you understand that, it's a different kind of conversation.
Talk about your business today and being an entrepreneur, because it goes from you and only having to focus, let's say, on yourself and a couple people. And today you have 40 plus people in the agency. I've always noticed in my businesses when they've gotten bigger, I spend a lot of my time focused on personalities, being chief psychiatrist, and that took me away from being able to grow the business further. Have you encountered that in building your business?
Yeah. I mean, a friend of mine was telling me that there's this amazing course at Harvard where it's for CEOs that are running a service business. And I said, look, I don't have time to take off a week and go to Harvard. Could you tell me what you learned?
Give me the cliff notes.
And he said, yeah, if you're a CEO of a service business, you can't be doing the service. And I'm like, well, I'm definitely not going to that course.
Because, right.
You know, that's what I do, you know? So I think it's really, really challenging to be both the CEO and also be doing the service yourself. Because as you said, I think some of the frustration of being a CEO in a service business is that you're all of a sudden the HR director and, you know, handling the holiday party and giving out staff gifts and whatever it is, you know. But I think, you know, learning to delegate and empower other people is really, really important. And really having the right people around you that you have confidence in that can do some of that stuff. But I think what's the most important is to set up the vision so that people that work for you know what your vision is and can carry it out. And I think that oftentimes I just feel like, all right, I'll just do it myself. But I think it's really important to be able to express to the people around you what it is that you want to see happen. And, you know, for me, a lot of my vision is creating a very collaborative environment, creating an environment where people feel empowered, creating an environment where people feel very positive and they feel like they're learning and they're growing professionally and personally all the time. And that's really challenging. So, you know, I really like to think about professional development and bringing in speakers. And we have a weekly lunch so that everybody, you know, from the different groups can talk to each other. And we have done, you know, some team building workshops. And oftentimes I feel like we don't do enough of that because we're all so busy.
Sure.
But, you know, living in New York, we all work so hard. It's really important to be able to figure out how we can all take a step back and really hone our skills and continue to learn and grow. And so I try to focus on how important that is in running a business and not see that as like the tedious part of the business.
More from our guest, but first a word from our sponsors. How Success Happens is brought to you by JustWorks. JustWorks is here to support the small business superheroes working hard to protect their companies and take care of their teams. With simple software and expert support for payroll, benefits, compliance, and HR, JustWorks takes some of the guesswork out of running a business in good times and bad. They know small business leaders wear many hats, and they're here to help you do it all. With JustWorks, you get seamless tools for managing remote teams and navigating new legislation. This includes scheduling, tracking, and staying compliant with new leave requirements from day one. Their dedicated team of certified HR consultants can help you navigate the ins and outs of managing remote teams in these challenging times. And should you or your team ever have any questions about your benefits or payroll, you can call JustWorks anytime. Really, anytime. 11 p.m. on Sunday? Sure. The round-the-clock support team is standing by. JustWorks is here for those who do it all. Learn more at justworks.com/success. That's justworks.com/success. And we're back. I love the story and now understanding, you know, starting, this all started because you wanted to affect, you didn't even know if you could, but you wanted to affect positive change. And going back to that with Jews at the time in Russia in the 80s. And do you still feel today running this number one lobbying firm, and I've seen like so many of the accolades and clients, like, do you at your heart, do you still get the satisfaction like you feel like you are making positive change and doing what you kind of set out to do?
Oh, absolutely. We just passed, we worked very closely with the speaker and many of the council members to pass the largest group of animal rights bills. And I'm so proud of that.
I love that as a new puppy owner.
Yes. Yes. You're adorable puppy. We have been working with the American Cancer Society and Tobacco-Free Kids on lots of legislation over the last number of years. And we just had recent success as well on legislation around smoking. We are still working on menthol ban. Unfortunately, that hasn't passed yet, but I've not given up on that. So there are so many things that we're working on all the time that are incredibly meaningful to me. We represent an amazing charter school up in Harlem that works with kids who literally have failed out of other schools. Mm-hmm. It's called the Opportunity Charter School. The city has tried to close them down.
So
and
awful.
We are trying to keep them open because nobody has any plan for these kids other than to send them back to their failing schools. These kids come in fourth, fifth grade, and they can't read. They can't do basic arithmetic. I visited the school many times. I am blown away by the commitment of the teachers and the head of the school, Lenny Goldberg. So I'm so committed to that and to so many of the not-for-profits, you know, represent City Meals on Wheels. I'm also on the board. Love so many of the not-for-profits that we work with, the cultural organizations, social service organizations, Safe Horizon, and so many others that I've worked with for 20 plus years. So really, really committed to the work that we do and really see this as a mission.
And that's so great to hear because it sounds like so much of what you're still doing and personally doing is really personal to you and making positive changes. And I know we don't have too much time, but I want to totally shift and just ask you because knowing you, you are out at night, you're up early, you are in great shape, you work out like Tracy Anderson, like 7 days a week. Like, and really important as an entrepreneur is being able to take care of yourself like that. With how are you able, I've always wondered, how are you able to do that? And does one play into the other by being able to exercise and keep you fresh and active and you eat well? So tell me about that because I think that's so important as an entrepreneur.
Well, I know that you're somebody who works out and really eats well.
Yes, 7 days. Really not as well as you, but no. I
see you with your shakes in the morning.
Yeah, I got my shakes, but I also have my slice of pizza from Freddie and Pepper's at 3 p.m. or...
I know about your interest in wellness and really kind of being a leader in that area. And I share that and really share that so much of being able to, you know, stress produces cortisol. Cortisol is probably the thing that makes people sick and prevents people from really achieving their potential on so many levels. And, you know, I think really figuring out for every person, you know, what works for them. I don't think I'm there 100%, but for me, you know, the Tracy Anderson method is, it's really hard. It's really challenging. When I finish, I feel like I can do anything. And I feel like it's a place that I can kind of use to really sharpen my brain as well as sharpen my own physical strength. And I feel like I'm somebody who's incredibly physically strong and mentally strong. And that really makes me feel like I can do what it takes to like listen carefully to people's problems and help them come up with a solution.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And there's no doubt it's working both ways, all the way. You are super inspiring. I mean, you're incredible. We've seen, I mean, as I talked about the awards and top 50 most powerful women in New York, but people who there's a reason for that. And knowing you, there's this incredible heart. And I love that your success and everything you've built came from this mission, just to want to help people. And I just think that it's so nice to see someone as successful as yourself who started that way and still carries that with them because, you know, I interview a lot of people on this show and people build major businesses, but a lot of times it's at the core isn't a mission.
So, well, I have to say that I'm very inspired by you and all the incredible commitment that you have to entrepreneurship and to helping people think about entrepreneurship and feeling that entrepreneurship is possible for them. And so this show, I think, is incredibly important. And you are a real inspiration, what you've done with so many businesses over the years. And, you know, and you never seem to stop. You always have ideas and you always, you know, always. But your commitment to helping others is really incredible. So I am honored to be on this show and I love what you're doing and keep doing it because people need to feel that this is possible. It seems so hard. And yet when you just take the first step,
I think that's right. I think it's that first step. Like you said, it was almost like, you know, as I said, I heard your husband, Bruce, pushing you and being like, what's wrong with you? Like, you got these clients, go do it. Like everyone and now you're this huge success, but like for the people listening and people who want to be entrepreneurs, that's like just the hardest thing is like, just jump off the diving board and like go for it. And I think through your story today, we've learned, and through other stories here, we learn that. So it's always like, if you're at that moment, like, you just got to go for it. So
absolutely.
Anyway, we will, I'm sure, continue to hear about all your successes and look forward to reading more.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Suri. And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.